This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome back to Aviation Extended. Australia has always mattered in aviation and defence, but over the past couple of years it's become much more visible on our stage and the world stage. From AUKUS and submarines to long-range strike, autonomous aircraft, maritime surveillance and the importance of the Indo-Pacific region, there's so much going on. To help make sense of it all, I'm joined by two very familiar voices from the excellent Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, Grant McCarron, who also presents the Australia Defence Magazine podcast, and of course, Steve Fisher. So let's catch up on what's going on. Welcome to Extended, guys.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be back. Have we been on this show before, Grant? I think we have.
Thanks, Peter. But yeah, I think, Steve, we've appeared in a few adverts, including the one where I got extended
every episode almost. Your voice is...
But the cracker was that time that I was on the rack trying to get extended, and we had fun with those adverts.
Oh, yes, I forgot those ones. That's not the one I'm running at the moment. No, but I should go back and use it. I think there was something to do with cricket at the time.
Oh, right. Don't mention the cricket.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. Get the cricket at the moment, just quietly. We should all move on.
Yes. Yeah, rugby's coming up, right?
Okay, yeah, let's move on to aeroplanes then. Just before we talk about defence and what's going on in Australia and aerospace, it has been a while. What have you guys been up to? Grant, let's start with you first. It's been a while, but what have you been doing in the world of aerospace and aviation recently? I think when we last talked to you, you were a self-described balloonatic.
I am still a balloonatic, although I'm a lapsed balloonatic. I got current post-COVID and then work got in the way, so I need to go and do my return to currency again. But I've also been doing a whole lot of airshow commentary and things like Avalon and Pacific Airshow Gold Coast and all that for specific teams or for the whole show. Yeah, I was working with defense for a while, but that's wound up in February. These days, I'm actually, these days I'm working with Australian Defense Magazine. I'm hosting their podcasts and I'm a journalist for them, going to events, doing all sorts of fun stuff with them. And there's not started yet, but it looks like there may be some consulting work to a couple of aviation organizations here in Australia, but I'll tell you more about that when I know it's actually happening and I've received the first check and it's cleared, you know.
Yeah, and we've seen some aeroplanes.
Yeah.
Steve, what have you been up to in the world of aerospace and aviation? Anything? I know lots of trains.
Yeah, lots of trains. I sort of work primarily in the rail industry still, and I still do a lot of production work in terms of audio.
Yeah.
Grant and I do a lot of production work for a number of other titles, and so that sort of keeps us busy. A bit of news reading on the radio, that sort of stuff. But aviation wise, probably not so much these days. I had a bit of a health scare a few years ago, which I haven't walked away from aviation, but it's not something that I sort of prioritized really sort of post that. So, I still love planes and I still, look skyward as they fly over all the time and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's hard to walk away from, but, I haven't really flown in years now myself.
Yeah.
But, I find myself every now and again sort of thinking, well, maybe I should investigate getting that medical back again. And maybe I'll have, I've changed lifestyles and sort of got a bit healthier and well, I'd like to think. So maybe I might do that again in the future. But, I still like to talk about planes a lot and Grant and I still occasionally record Plane Crazy Down Under. In fact, I'm reminded by an email from Grant today that we've got one in the can that I have.
but Steve, you also go flying pretty well on your motorbike these days.
Oh, yes. I'm right into motorcycling too. So, I have been flying around on my latest acquisition, which is a BMW, so I'm having a lot of fun with that. So, yeah, life is good.
And I don't, I don't know if I'm allowed to mention this, Steve, but I know you're planning a trip. Is there any particular aviation-related interest in that trip?
Yeah, you know, I've travelled a lot, but, you know, I end up always going back to North America for some reason. And my wife and I have done a little bit of travelling around Asia and across the Pacific and whatnot. But finally, in 2027, we're going to come to the UK, which I'm really looking forward to. It's something I wanted to do before I was 50, which I didn't manage to pull that off. But, yeah, 56 will do. So, yeah, we're planning about 4 weeks in the UK and a little bit of time in Holland. Next year, and I am so looking forward to that. So yes, places like Duxford are certainly going to be on the agenda for that.
Yeah. I've got
permission to at least indulge in aviation for a day or two there, which is going to be great.
Woo-hoo. Yeah. Obviously, we've had Dave Homewood, who's recently been trailing through the UK for the second or third time, mm-hmm. I think, and every time he comes, he does something different. And he embarrasses me into releasing content that even I'm like, gosh, I wish I'd have done that. I didn't know. And I'm sat here, you know, 50 miles from this place, and I didn't know that. So there's just so much here that we don't even know ourselves.
You know, funny, I've always wanted to visit the Mac Loop, but I don't know. So I don't think that'll be on the agenda for this trip. But and I believe that's something
you've
got to plan out and make sure you get there at the right day and the right time and the right spot.
And the right hiking gear.
The right hiking gear, yeah. So I don't think we'll do that on this trip, but yeah, if I can get to Duxford, I'll be wrapped.
Yeah, timing will be good, and you know, depends on what time of year. Regardless of whether there's a show on or not, there's often some activity that's pretty good, and that's also an area that's relatively rich in military airfields. You may be able to, on your way to and from, pass through several areas where you might be able to distract Kathy to go and have a cup of tea somewhere whilst you look over a fence or two.
Food, fabric, history, that can distract Kathy.
She knows me well enough. We've been together a long time. So
good.
Where you come in.
Well, let's get on to aerospace and defence. And as I said, it feels much more visible now, Australia, to us. Mm. You're very much more in the news here. And obviously AUKUS is a big deal, and it seems to be getting a lot bigger. I know you recently had a really interesting programme, actually, on the Defence magazine, which reflected on some of the growth and the challenges for that. But what's changing in Australian defence? Why am I seeing so much more than I ever have done?
Well, AUKUS is a really big part of that. And the tripartite agreement between the US, the UK, Australia, there's two pillars to it. The first is the submarines. And look, I've got to say, and many of us down here are saying, we're putting a lot of money into these submarines that won't be around till 30s, 40s, and that includes the secondhand Virginias from the US that we might get if they agree to it. And unfortunately, that's ripping capability out of the current world. They're taking money out of it. So much like the UK, we have a funding problem. But the pillar two is fantastic. Pillar one's the submarines. Pillar two is all the cool autonomous systems, AI, hypersonics, and all the really cool technologies. And I've quite enjoyed hanging out with the crew working on all that. And there's a lot of stuff going on. We've also got increased engagement between the UK and Australia. For instance, the Kinetics Dragonfire, the laser system, we've been doing a bit of stuff with them on that.
Right.
There's all sorts of things going on. And yeah, that would be bringing us up there. But I like yourselves, funding is tight.
And just jumping around a little bit, Grant, when I listened to the magazine podcast, I think it was a few weeks ago, there were a lot of challenges that your guests were bringing up that mm-hmm. seemed very practical to me. Yep. But one of the things I'd never thought through was that whole security issue and the joint security links.
Yeah,
and it just is. It seems so crazy that we're jointly developing this product and this operation, but we can't even get to share our own security links amongst ourselves to do it. It's bonkers.
Yeah, well, they have introduced a license-free environment so that it doesn't get rid of ITAR and all that kind of stuff, but it does give us an environment where the three parties can exchange info and things like that and work together in those environments. But combined or acknowledged security clearances, where if you have here in Australia that we have baseline, yeah, whatever, basically, and then you got NV1, which is secret, NV2, top secret, and then you get provisional vetting and so on. If we can at least get acknowledgement that if you've got this here in Australia, that means this level in the UK and that level in the USA, and get that level of agreement, that's the next cab off the rank. They've been working on that for a long time already for the last few years, and it's a hard one to get done. But if you... one of the key things about a security clearance here in Australia, and probably the same for everywhere else, is you have to be a citizen. And that has scuppered a number of projects. Telstra came in a while back to do comms for defense, and they came in and bid on the assumption that they would have transients, they'd have residential people, but not citizens, and outsource overseas. And defense said, no, you need to have security clearances, which means you've got to be citizens. Because if you want to go into a computer room without needing an escort, you have to have an NV2, a top secret clearance. That really restricts the pool of people you can recruit. So Tullis and Air Services are finding this right now with the combined OneSky, which is the new air traffic control system that will be both civilian and defense, all on the one network, which just happens to be defense's network, which means suddenly everyone has to have a minimum baseline. You then got your secret and top secret, depending on where you're at for management and IT admin and so on. And there's a whole lot of air traffic controllers and air services who aren't Australian citizens. All this kind of thing raises a whole lot of fun. And yeah, a lot of organizations just don't think of that.
Before we jump into some aviation and other challenges, the National Defence Strategy, mm-hmm. the Australian National Defence Strategy, talks about deterrence by denial. Mm-hmm. I keep hearing this term come up. What's that mean?
Well, there is the cynical view that Steve will know I'm very fond of, which is, you keep denying that the enemy's out there, nothing's going to happen, which seems to have been the way of our current and previous governments for quite a while. We've squandered quite a bit of time in this very turbulent geopolitical environment. But the real Australian strategy of denial means denying the ability to come close, into like denying access to the sea lanes to our north, things like that. So this is long-range precision strikes, the PrSM phase, increment 2 missile that's going to allow you to launch towards an area, then it opens its seeker and finds the target and attacks it that way. Because PrSM increment 1 and a number of the other missiles, you say you go here and you hit, and if you've got a moving target, it's already moved. So this is where we're looking at having long range strike with that ability. So it makes an enemy think twice about coming close. What it doesn't do is deny them the ability to lob a few ballistic missiles at us and things. We have a couple of NASAMS groups, the surface-to-air missiles, the short-range ground-based defense. But Australia suddenly realized, based on what they're seeing in the Middle East, especially, we need medium-range ground-based.
Bit exposed, aren't you?
We've got our Hobart-class frigates, three of, one of which happens to be laid up getting all its upgrades, that could possibly do this. So a lot of stuff going on there. But the whole strategy of denial is denying the ability for the bad guys to get close to us. So literal maneuvers into the islands to our north and everything, and long-range precision naval maritime strike.
Yeah. And that the point about the air defense challenge is a great – was it your last episode or two? I can't remember. Quite sobering to see how limited your air defense is for the nation. I'm not saying the UK's is a great deal better, but we seem to all be relying as maritime states on our ships to protect us. But in reality, you know, we can see through history, you can go back to things like the Falkland Islands, where we felt we had massive and heavily protected defence forces. But in reality, there was always a way through. Yeah. And as we've seen in the Middle East recently, you know, $20 drones sometimes slip through these big defence systems. Talking about drones, UAVs, and that sort of challenge, is there any focus on that from an air defence perspective in that discussion?
We have the Land 156 project, which is counter UAS and primarily small UAS. So that one, I was interviewing the general in charge of it, and he was saying his favourite line, which is, in the old days of procurement, if we'd go out and order an iPhone, and we'd buy a whole lot of iPhones, but by the time you got them, they were a year and a half out of date. So they're looking at doing things a lot faster and learning from everything. Steve, I believe we've got an episode coming out in the near future on drones, haven't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing about drones, and we're seeing that everywhere around the world, is the such rapid development cycles that go around it. So, you know, when you go to a, you know, defense manufacturer, and they might talk about development cycles being, you know, 3 months, where, so, you know, technology that you've got coming out now is potentially already going to be obsolete by the time it goes in theater. You know, that's a problem for militaries around the world. But, you know, when it comes to defending Australia, I mean, one of the things we rely on a lot traditionally, I think, probably is the tyranny of distance. It makes it, you know, difficult for a potential enemy to sustain a logistics trail, if nothing else, if they're going to come to our major population centres. But now that we're looking at these technologies and the way they're developing, that's becoming less of a problem for any potential enemy. So, you know, that's always going to be, you know, an issue for any defence planner now in this part of the world. The question is, how quickly do we keep up? And, I mean, that's, you know, a question that people like Grant on that podcast are always asking, because, you know, how do we defend against something like that? How do we, you know, denial can work both ways when you think about it. We can rely on the tyranny of distance, but, you know, that can work for us or against us, depending on we might do us harm.
When the Chinese can launch their bombers from the Scarborough Atoll areas, you know, all those South China Sea former atolls and reefs that have now become full islands with 10,000-foot runways, they can launch out of there, launch their missiles before they even get close to Australia and take out our southern capitals. It's, the world has changed, and the geopolitics are getting real interesting. So, yeah, the denial is when they're coming closer to us, yes. But, you know, as Steve said, it's an interesting world, and the drones are, you know, like the imagine the Ukrainian attack that they did with the trucks carrying a whole lot of drones, Spiderweb, Operation Spiderweb. Imagine a freighter coming in that happens to have a container on the top layer, and as it pulls into port, it opens up and a whole lot of drones come out. And if that happened in Williamtown, they're right next door to the military base there. Look at the Saronic drone vessels, or the ones that Ukraine are using to control the Black Sea. Yeah. Again, a freighter ship comes close, but it's actually operating, much like the ones that have been dragging their chains over comms lines and so on, and power lines.
Yeah.
Imagine that it drops off a whole lot of remote vessels while it's still out at sea, but they all come in at night and cause grievous bodily harm.
Yeah. Blimey. New Cold War. Let's stay in the air. Let's talk about the Air Force, you know, F-35A, Super Hornet, the Growler. How's this all building up into an integrated Air Force, or is it just a number of platforms that all work independently?
It's very integrated. Australia's been going for, especially from the Air Force's front and also the rest now, for a networked assault force, a networked defence, attack, etc. So the F-35 is like a mini AWACS when it wants to be. Without using its radar, the F-35 can get so much information. It's like Flight Radar 24 with passive sensors. The F-35 connects in with the new Hobart class Aegis based air warfare destroyers. It's going to connect in with the Hunter class frigates. We also have the E-7A Wedgetail, the MC-55 Peregrine that's now coming online. In fact, we haven't even hit IOC and we've already got them out there because of what's going on in the Philippines area. So they're going out there doing the Peregrine is basically, I've been told, it's like a Hoover of the electromagnetic spectrum, sucking everything up and analyzing it and so on, doing signals and communications intelligence. But it's also a relay. It can take information from, because not everyone talks Link 16 or Link 22 and so on.
Yeah.
So it will bring information in and rebroadcast it back out for the others. So it's like a big translator in the sky. There's all this stuff going on. And even our KC-30A tankers have got Link 16 nodes to give them that networking capability and relaying to act as a relay out there. The whole point is to have everyone linked together. It means that you're getting oceans of data, which you have to then make information to get intelligence. But that's where, you know, Elastic and various other products are helping out there, but and AI and so on. But we definitely have a networked Air Force that is now also networked with the joint force of Navy and Army as well.
Wow. And I was lucky enough to see the Ghost Bat. Farnborough, an intriguing piece of equipment. How's that integrating with the F-35 for you guys?
It's not just the F-35. They're talking about having about 3 Ghost Bats per manned aircraft. So if you just take the F-35, Growler and Super Hornet, that's about 300 Ghost Bats. But the reality is
Blimey.
They're going to be using them for protection of tankers, AWACS, like the E-7A Wedgetail, all this kind of stuff. Because if you can have drone, remote, you know, collaborative combat aircraft protecting those high-value assets, then it means that your manned assets can be off doing prosecution of the enemy and various other tasks. But, you've mentioned the ADM podcast and listening to that. Steve has the misfortune of having to listen to every episode because he edits it. And Steve, I think you've picked up a lot of information thanks to osmosis from listening to all these episodes we put out, haven't you?
It's interesting because, I remember even I'm playing crazy all those years ago when they started talking about the concept of a networked battle space, and everybody you talk to from Lockheed Martin, for example, when, you know, they come out and they talk about in very technical terms about how this would work. And it was kind of a foreign concept to us at the time. But now that we have 72 of those aircraft now, a lot of people in this space sort of thought, well, really, is that enough? And I think originally, Grant, I think they wanted 100 of them when they came. But it's sort of evolved now where they're able to work with smaller numbers now and augment that with things like the Ghost Bat, which allows them to sort of project, you know, our coverage and our reach a bit further, you know, probably a lot further, arguably, than we did before. So I think that's sort of embracing the sort of, you know, the technology that we need. And again, it comes a lot down to the vast distances that we need to be able to cover and to defend when we're sending our forces out to do that sort of work. So cognizant of the fact, too, that any potential enemy, I don't know whether we can mention who they are, but I think everybody knows who that would be, which I think geographically is difficult for Australia in and of itself, because if we're talking about China, they're also our biggest trading partner. So that's a constant dance that's having to go on.
Yeah,
but we're seeing
that all around the world, aren't we?
You look at them; they're not fools. The Chinese, they are very clever, and they are developing a pace to this technology. We all know this, so getting this technology on board into our military and making sure that it works in an optimal fashion is vital.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome from the Royal Aeronautical Society. The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
So we talked earlier, Steve mentioned distance is a deterrence, but Australia is also being seen, particularly by the Northern Hemisphere, as projecting itself into the Indo-Pacific region and using its platforms to do that. We've talked about, you know, the wedge tails, we've talked about the P8s. Australia's got quite a modern force to project up into that area. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there, because you mentioned the Philippines there. People in my part of the world probably don't know much of what Australia is involved in.
Well, we've got the famous nine-dash line of the Chinese South China Sea area, the first island chain, the second island chain, and I referenced Scarborough Shoal and various other parts. The latest is that China has built up near the sort of Vietnam area. There's basically a whole lot of islands, Spratlys, Scarborough, all this kind of area that China says is theirs. The international naval, the UN law of the sea has come down and said, no, they're not yours, but China determines that they're not going to recognize this, and they're just going out there and developing them. And this is where you've got the Philippines with their rust bucket old ship that they ran aground on one reef, and as they go and try and resupply it, the Chinese Coast Guard is out there with water cannons. There was a classic video last year of a Chinese naval ship and Coast Guard ship trying to intercept, and pretty much it looked like they were trying to ram a Philippine Navy ship, except they ran into each other. And the video from the Philippine Navy, and it's been confirmed that a couple of Chinese sailors have died in that. So it's pretty full on. And this is going on. So Australia's got its Peregrine aircraft, the MC-55As, out there listening. We have in the past sent it used to be the P-3s and things like that, and especially our AP-3CEW ones, the secret squirrels, looked like the others but had a little bit more on board, and doing all that intelligence gathering. We've got the P-8s going up there. They're doing international rite of passage kind of things, you know, like freedom of navigation. We're also sending our ships through. So you fly close to some of these islands and you get voices of obvious Asian descent coming on the radio, not identifying themselves, but saying, go away, you're in the wrong place, you shouldn't be here. And they're continuously broadcasting. We're following international rules. We are in international airspace. We do not agree with your thing, et cetera, et cetera. So the P-8s are doing that. The Hobarts and some of our Anzac frigates have been in the area. The Yellow Sea, helping to enforce the North Korean sanctions. So we're doing a lot of that in the Indo-Pac area. But basically the indications are that China is extending its territory, not just to have very huge runways that they can launch attacks from, but they're also putting a whole lot of listening posts out there for underwater, so that it's becoming very, very hard for a submarine to operate in that area without someone detecting it. There's a lot going on, plus also every one of these places that they fortify, they've got medium and short range ground-based air defense. So if you want to come through and get close, that porcupine is going to really hurt you.
And I suppose that begs the question of the integration between the Navy and the Air Force, and particularly with the use of autonomous systems. How closely are they integrated? You mentioned earlier the Hobart class.
Yeah, the Aegis system, Lockheed Martin have done demonstrations recently where, and Australia's partaken in some of them, where an F-35 gets the targeting information and relays it via the network to the an Aegis-based, in our case, the Hobart, which launches a missile at that target. You know, that these kind of things are real. And so there's lots of integration between Air Force and Navy, and Army is coming online with it as well. And the whole point is to be able to share information to build that awareness. But you also have to be able to work in degraded kind of environments. As we've seen, Middle East and Ukraine, airliners flying in the area having to turn off their GPS-based systems and rely on inertial navigation before they even get anywhere close, because you've got, especially some of the latest aircraft, civilian aircraft, rely on GPS for their stability. And there's been a few of them that have gotten into a bit of an upset because suddenly they were told, no, actually, you're 500 kilometers to the right. So all this kind of stuff is going on. So the network force is important, but you've got to be able to work in an environment where it's being actively jammed and so on. And that's been quite fascinating to look at the EW side of what's going on. That for the Air Force is your Peregrine, but also your Growler. The Growler is a tactical jammer. The US have the Compass Call aircraft. They were C-130s, they're now corporate jets. And they're like a leaf blower. They're out there just jamming everything in the EW, you know, electromagnetic spectrum area. And I don't think we're going to get those, but we're doing pretty well with what we've got with the E-7, the P-8, the Peregrine, and even the KC-30 being in the network, plus the F-35, those ESA radars, the Advanced Electronically Steerable Array radars that you find on the F-35, on the Super Hornet Growler, the E-7, and even the P-8 with some of the US ones having that canoe fairing underneath the front. Very cool. That's a whole ESA radar there as well. They don't just detect. They can also jam. The joy of an ESA is because it's electronic. You can, on the left side, be sensing, and on the right side, for this one particular area, be jamming, which of course gives you away. But once you're detected, who cares? Or if you want to do a shock and awe attack, you know. So all these kind of things, we're up with it. We may not have all the latest and greatest that the US has, but we're pretty close, and we're doing spiral increments for the P-8, the F-35, and so on, and the Super Hornets Growlers, where we're trying to stay in lockstep with the U.S. military, particularly the U.S. Navy, where we get our Growlers and Supers through there.
Mobility is important, and supporting those forces from a humanitarian perspective as well. But there's a lot of investment in particularly the northern bases that you have in Australia, so you're able to protect that. We've mentioned the KC-30. I'm quite interested in it because, of course, in the UK we've got the same platform as well. How's that performing?
It's doing really well. You've got the Voyager in the UK has just the wingtip pods for probe and drogue refueling, but the ones we've got, the KC-30As, also have the flying boom. And during the Middle East situation many years ago, I do recall a US the head of the US forces in the Middle East being on board a KC-30 and seeing how much could refuel other aircraft, how long it could stay on target and in its area, and saying, this is what we need. Why do we not have a fleet of these? They're a very, very capable aircraft. I mean, yes, okay, during testing, a boom fell off, which a lot of various other companies pointed the finger and laughed until their own boom fell off, which has happened to everyone. So, but these days, very capable, automated refueling, where the receiving aircraft and the tanking aircraft can talk to each other, and there's no, you're all hands off as it's happening. So we got that. We've also got the C-17 strategic transport and the C-130J. We're getting some more of them. Steve's favourite aircraft, I might point out.
I was just about to say, I've got to bring Steve in there because it's a story that bounces around the PTDU studio perpetually.
I wasn't going to mention it.
I think you've been on one, haven't you, Steve?
I might have been, yeah. What a day.
a certain producer there and co-host was on the flight deck of a C-130H for its final media flight across Sydney.
I glance across to the glorious picture on the side of my studio here. There it is. Yeah, yeah, it's well, you know, the saying is the only replacement for a Hercules is another Hercules. So we've got 12 of them at the moment, and we've got another 20 on order. So it'd be good to see them come. And interestingly, our friends across the Tasman have actually just replaced their very old C-130s and brought in, was it 4 or 5, I think, Grant, C-130Js into the Royal New Zealand Air Force. So such an amazing platform. My absolute favourite aircraft. I think everyone who listens would know that. But bring in 20 more after that, I say.
I was lucky enough to also have a little trip in the back of one. So I know what you mean. But we, of course, got the A400M, mm-hmm. which is replacing the Hercules here. And I'm quite lucky where I live that we occasionally get the low-level passes of those. And I think it's starting to prove itself. It's got a slightly wider load-bearing capability. So it's interesting to see how Airbus are creeping into that market, you know, which was, gosh, for decades and decades and decades has been the sole propriety of the Hercules, really, the C-130.
Well, you've also got the
other end of that scale. We've got the fleet of C-27Js, the Spartans, but they're being phased out after, and it took a lot of assessment and evaluation to bring those in, and they sort of came in as a battlefield airlifter and, you know, to replace the Caribous, which were a very aging but still amazingly versatile platform. You could almost argue we could still have kept the Caribous in service. I think the Army would have liked that, but for all of the best will in the world, the defence have decided that these platforms really haven't worked out as they'd hoped, and they're looking to get rid of them, which is a real shame, really.
There's a couple of reasons behind that, unfortunately. One is the self-protection measures. They've not been able to implement and certify those. There's been some cracking in the empennage area and our fuselage due to the grunt, shall we say, of those engines on the C-27J. I mean, I had the first media flight ever for the RAF on a C-27J, and it was a hoot, baby Hercules indeed. but yeah, the cost per hour, they're saying that's too high. They were supposed to be a fixed wing Chinook, was how when they came in, the Chief of Army was referring to them as the ability for a battlefield airlifter to go into the hot spots and do all that. They've certainly shown themselves to be incredible for humanitarian assistance and disaster recovery. And there is a derogatory phrase being used of a South Pacific taxi because they're being used for a lot of work in our region. But the Defence Force is saying that they could do it cheaper with civilian leased aircraft, or they're talking about King Airs. But there's also the possibility of the CASA C-295s that a number of groups operate and was in the running against the C-27J. And a big thing that led us to getting it was that the US Air Force was using them. And not long after we signed up and went foreign military sale, FMS, they said, oh, okay, we're getting rid of them and giving them to the Coast Guard. They're not working out. And it was like, well, great. We've got them. Getting some of the data required, because the Yanks had walked away, we couldn't get it, or it was going to cost too much to get information about fatigue, life, and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's a real shame because they're a beautiful aircraft. They're a lot of fun. The folks who fly them really like them, but it's just not working out, apparently.
And you mentioned briefly their rotary. Yep. What's the state of rotary aircraft in the defense
force? An interesting saga on itself.
Well, we had the MRH-90s, the Taipans, we called them. So that's the NH-90 equivalent, the the naval helicopter. And for a variety of factors, the official just wasn't working out. It wasn't, you know, they couldn't make it work with access to spares and maintenance and so on. The Kiwis, however, have got the same helicopter and they're doing very well with it. But that's because they have a single place to do the maintenance. They plan well in advance for ordering parts, things like they've learnt how to do it. A number of factors went against them in our army, and there's a number of comments, shall we say, relating to how they're being maintained versus the Australian systems, the Airbus systems, the integration or lack thereof, blah, blah, blah. But basically, we buried them. We stripped a few things off them to give to sell to others, and they literally dug a hole and buried them. When
blimey.
And there is the cynical view that a number of people in the industry have, which is, if we had given them to Ukraine and been the heroes for donating helicopters to Ukraine and Ukraine made them work, we'd look really stupid. That's a very nasty way of looking at it. There were problems, right, especially the Top Owl helmets. They could introduce vertigo, and we lost a helicopter. It was low. It was night. It was, things didn't work out, and that's been really tragic. But I think we could have done better. But they just decided, no, we're off. We've gone back to the Black Hawk. We have the UH-60 Mikes, the M's, and we have the MH-60 Romeos in the Navy. So that's a growing fleet there for Sikorsky, Lockheed Martin Sikorsky, to maintain here in Australia, and was the reason I was just in Albury the other day for related to that. But, it's we've got those. We've got the Apaches coming online. And I have it on guy with a beer kind of thing, because one of the concerns a number of us had about the Apache is our Canberra-class LHDs, the landing helicopter docks. The Apache, you have to take the rotor blades off because they don't fold to get it down into the hangar because the elevators are too narrow based on the rotor diameter. I don't know if they're putting folds in or if they've come up with something else. They're not exactly marinized, but they're going to use them. But when I've raised this with a couple of people, they've said, look, we can't tell you, but all we can say is, yeah, we know, and we're working on it, and we've got cunning plans. So, you know, we've got okay. that. We, of course, have the Chinooks. We currently have the ARH Tigers, the Airbus aircraft, that are doing very well for the French and so on, but we've decided to replace them with Apaches. So, a joke that I have heard around the place is nobody got fired for buying American, thus Black Hawk, Seahawk, Apache, Chinook, etc. But, we do a lot of work with the Americans, so having an integrated fleet,
yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you automatically get everything the Americans have, because there are a few things that we've had issues with. We've asked for an upgrade and we've been told no. So we'll see.
Well, so much going on. Really appreciate you guys taking some time out to give us this update. Really enjoyed it. Really interesting stuff. Most importantly, though, as we wrap up, where can we find you online? Grant, let's start with you.
Well, aside from playingcrazydownunder.com, of course, the Australian Defence Magazine podcast, and also writing articles for them and doing a few other things on their social medias and all that kind of stuff. So that's australiandefence.com.au, and you'll find a whole lot of stuff there. They're a great bunch. I'm really enjoying working with them, and I've been engaged doing stuff with them for quite some time and really, really enjoying it. It's opening up a lot of opportunities, and I'm having fun there.
Yeah, it's a great podcast. Recommend it. Steve, how can we find you?
Well, of course, as Grant mentioned, you can find us at playingcrazydownunder.com. But a little project I did a year or so back that I turned into a radio show was called The Clear Signal. So you can find that at clearsignal.com.au. There's 40 interviews there. There might be a couple of aviation ones in there. But, sort of stepping away and doing some stuff a bit more generalised, actually, and that was a lot of fun too. So I'd invite people to drop in there. And, of course, there's a show we're producing at the moment between all of us called A History of the Future. That is a project that's hoovering up a lot of my time at the moment, but it's been a fantastic, it's just a joy to work on. So we're really keen to really get that up and running. So ahistoryofthefuture.com.au.
That's the one.
And no, is that going to be a podcast?
Oh, no. So ahistoryofthefuture.com.au, and it's already three episodes in. Ewan, who puts it together, does the research, does the narration. Steve, and I'm going to say this, mate, does some of the best work I've ever heard on any audio production. Music, sound effects, narration, all working it together. We've got three episodes out. And what Ewan does is he looks at a country from prehistoric times to now and assesses and explains the mental approach that country has, and it helps explain what they're doing now and into the future. Yeah. First episode was China. Next one was Russia. We've done India. Currently, Steve is slaving away over the United States of America episode.
Oh, looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that one.
It's interesting. But
really, you remember, Peter, back in the day when we used to do those little skits for our friends at the Airplane Geeks, and yep, put all those corny sound effects together? Well, I've kind of moved on from that, but it's stuff I learned back in those days.
But the principles are the same.
Stepped it up a bit.
If you like the Australia desk that were sort of like radio plays, those episodes, this amps it up to 11. In fact, it amps it up to 111. It is...
Right. So it's got an Australian style to it, has it?
Oh, it's international, but...
I don't know. The presenter's got an accent more like yours, Peter, actually.
Has he? Okay.
He was born in the US, but he was raised for a bit in the US and then has been in Australia for quite some time. He's a world traveler. He's also... I work with him at Australian Defence Magazine, which was how we got to start on this. And... It's fantastic. I really enjoy listening to them. And yes, like Ewan does great research and presents a really good story, and Steve's knocking it out of the park. And what do I do? Yeah, they use my pen occasionally for corrections, and I update things on the website, and that's it. I listen and
he's our sounding board. Okay. He's our sounding board.
Yeah. Well, we'll put links to all of those in the show notes. So guys, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, mate. It's been great to catch up, and it's been way too long since we last caught up, and we've got such a shared heritage from the Airplane Geeks. But yeah, we should. It's been great working with you.
We've got to do something, haven't we? We've got to do a Geeks insert at some time.
A combined Oz desk, perhaps.
Okay, guys, listen, thanks so much for your time.
Cheers.
Cheers, mate.
Lots of fun there with Grant and Steve, of course, from Plane Crazy Down Under. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music, and we'd like you to go out and buy our book, Constant Endeavour, all about RAF Coastal Command, of course. It's audiobook and ebook, and you can find it on all major platforms and the ebook through Amazon. Every single penny we raise goes to Help for Heroes, so we'd really be grateful if you'd go out and help us generate some money for that very, very good cause. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can also find me at xdpmedia.co.uk and all my other platforms. I'm also the host of the Partnership Edge podcast. You can find Gareth, Tim and Ellie on their personal and, of course, through the extended social feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. This is Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.